gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ according to Mark. Jesus took with him Peter and James and John and led them up a high mountain apart by themselves. And he was transfigured before them, and his clothes became dazzling white, such as no one on earth could bleach them. And there appeared to them Elijah with Moses, who were talking with Jesus. Then Peter said to Jesus, "Rabbi, it is good for us to be here. Let us make three dwellings, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." He did not know what to say, for they were terrified. Then a cloud overshadowed them, and from the cloud there came a voice, "This is my Son, the Beloved. Listen to him." Suddenly, when they looked around, they saw no one with them anymore, but only Jesus. As they were coming down the mountain, he ordered them to tell no one about what they had seen until after the Son of Man had risen from the dead. The Gospel of our Lord.
This is the story of Jesus being transfigured on the mountain, kind of the short version in the Gospel according to Mark. And we're hearing this story because it is the last Sunday of Epiphany, and we're about to get launched into the season of Lent, which is going to take us in a different direction. And I suppose those who created the lectionary used by all the mainline denominations now, the Revised Common Lectionary, the intent is to kind of keep us mindful, right, of who this Jesus is. He goes up on the mountaintop, and if you've ever, I was thinking about Bob Reed this week, because at one point Bob had committed himself to climbing all, is it 23 peaks in the Tahoe Basin over 10,000 feet? Is there 23 of them, or? In the four, yeah, which is higher than either one of us can count. Okay, so a lot, more than three, let's put it that way. More than three peaks, and Bob was going to climb all of them over 10,000 feet. Have you ever done that? Have you climbed? No, just one. I mean, just one. No. Yeah, I don't expect anybody to be as loony as Bob. Talac or Friel or Job's Peak or Genoa or any of those. I mean, do you remember what they... By the time you get to the top, your legs are rubbery and your lungs are burning and your head is spinning because it's above 10,000 feet. But on top of that mountain, you see the world in a whole different way, don't you? And it can be this wonderful, sometimes painful, depending on the shape that you're in, kind of spiritual moment. It's this wonderful thing. Well, you know, Jesus gets up there with Peter, James, and John. His raiment is transfigured, and everybody's having a problem. And we're going to come back to that in a moment. But first, I want to ask you folks, who here has seen the movie Wonder? Billy? Oh, it's based on a book? Oh, that's right, a children's book. Okay. So if you haven't seen this movie, put it in your Netflix queue when it comes out. It's at the $4 theater. Marietta and I snuck over there yesterday afternoon because we were just feeling lazy, and we watched this movie, and it's fabulous. It's just a wonderful, sweet movie about this kid who is disfigured from birth. And his mother homeschools him because he is so disfigured, but finally, at some age, I can't remember his age, maybe fifth grade or something like that, they all decide he's going to start going to school, and he's afraid. And over the course of this movie, what happens is that he is not transfigured, but everyone else around him is. It's a cool movie. Watch it if you get a chance. So, with the anticipation of all of the rest of us being transfigured over the next few minutes, I give you Phil Ritger. Don't blow it.
So for those of you who are visiting today, I apologize in advance. I have climbed to the top of Jump's Peak. Never do it with your youngest daughter, who had just come back from college and having spent 4 years in an outing club hiking the White Mountains of New Hampshire. She decided that we were going to hike Jump's Peak, and I think we did it in under 2 hours. I was... Well, it was in a sense, but you're absolutely right. It gives you a different perspective on the world when you're up there. It was quite amazing. Father Jeff wanted me to talk to you today about sort of where I, myself, where I came from and my presence here. And it really starts, I've got to go back to my days in Wisconsin. I grew up in a small little town in Wisconsin, population probably around the same as what's here in the Carson Valley, about 30-some thousand people, with 12 Catholic churches. So I wasn't even sure growing up as a kid that there was any other religion besides Roman Catholic. In a large extended family, my dad was one of 12 children. My mom was one of seven sisters, no brothers, seven daughters who ran a dairy farm. And with a large family, I mean, when we had family get-togethers, it wasn't uncommon to have around 90 to 100 people there, and that was just aunts, uncles, and the unmarried first cousins. Grew up serving this large family, and I remember in the Catholic faith there. There were numerous times it was probably a disappointment to my mom, but I know the one was when I decided in eighth grade to go to a traditional high school and decided not to go to the seminary. For them, it was the ticket to heaven. If they could get me enrolled in seminary, she had that key to heaven. Now, in retrospect, I have to tell you, I have two aunts who were Roman Catholic nuns. There was a priest in the family and a Capuchin monk in the family. So I was a huge disappointment to them. I grew up Roman Catholic, attended St. Mary's Catholic Church and school. So I went to school in the Catholic parochial school for K through 8th grade. And in addition to not going into seminary, the one thing I do remember and probably I don't want to tell you about is when I got expelled from Catholic school in the 3rd grade. So I remember it like it was yesterday. Sister Helen, we were studying the lessons on mortal and venial sins. For those of you who aren't familiar with that, a mortal sin was if you committed that, you were going straight to hell. There was no ticket, no key, no way back out. You couldn't repent from that one. Venial sin just meant, say, for our fathers, 10 Hail Marys, and you were back in good grace. Till the next time, correct. But this was after Vatican II and the Vatican II reforms. When prior to that, if you were a faithful Catholic and you happened to eat meat on a Friday, that was a mortal sin. And I remember Sister Helen was talking about that, and that one stuck in my mind. So I immediately asked that question. I was that inquisitive kid who couldn't, you know, had to always push the envelope even at that age. So I asked her, I said, so all those people who ate meat on Friday and are in hell, what happens? Did they just all get let back out? And I remember her response, she kind of tap danced around a little bit, and her final response was, well, if they were willing to eat meat on Friday, they probably did far worse things, and so no, they're still in hell and they're not getting out. As you can tell, that didn't really fly for me. And I guess recollection, I don't remember what I did, but I pushed the envelope just a little too far that time. And the next thing I know, my mom is there at the school picking me up for my 3-day suspension because I had gotten hauled down to Sister Catherine's office, which she was the principal. This school was run by nuns, by the way. And so there I was, a complete disappointment with my mom. But and the reason I'm telling you that story is because what it to this day still reminds me and why I like this prayer so much is, and what I've probably looked for in my faith tradition is that we don't, interpret Scripture literally. We put it in context. We talk about it in the context of when it was written, what the political climate was, what was happening at the time, and we go forward from there. And that's something I really appreciate at this parish. The other story from my childhood deals with our family vacations. We weren't wealthy, but my parents always made a point of a family trip every summer. It was always a road trip, piled into the car. Recently at my dad's memorial service, I told the crowd, I said, to picture a Norman Rockwell painting of a jubilant family rolling down the byways of America in the car with no air conditioning, driver's side window rolled down, my father's left arm resting on the door frame with the wind rushing past. I never remembered whether Dad was doing that for the breeze, or the cool breeze, or simply to generate white noise to drown out us three misbehaving kids in the back seat. But either way, that was our family tradition. Father Fred Kulowitz, who was the priest at our home parish in Wisconsin, at my parents' 50th wedding anniversary, which was back in 2001, reminded me of the story as a child that he said on one of those family vacations, as we left the house, the car rolled out, and instead of heading towards the freeway, we headed towards the church. Pulled up in front, my mom turned around, handed me an envelope, and said, "Go up to the parish to the rectory and hand this to the priest." Well, it was our weekly contribution for the next two Sundays that we'd be gone. When I asked my mom about that, I mean, it was sort of odd that we would take time out of our vacation to stop at the church first. And her comment to us was that, well, that was our family. That was our church family. And we weren't going to leave without making sure they were taken care of first. That kind of stuck with me to this day. Well, I went off to college, graduate school. As typical rebellion youth, especially out of the Catholic faith, I fell away from any kind of organized religion during that period of time. And it wasn't until I started working in the Chicago area that I went back and found sort of a parish life. Again, 12 Catholic churches in my hometown, so the first thing I went to is the local Catholic church in the town I was living in Chicago. Wasn't there really long enough to feel like I'd found a family yet before I transferred out to Southern California. Got there and started attending a Catholic church near the place where I purchased a home. And those of you who don't know me, my wife Chris is not here today. I met Chris, we started dating, and for those, again, in the Catholic faith, we have something which is just beautiful. It's the Saturday evening mass. So you don't have to worry, you don't spend Sunday morning here. I mean, it's probably the best thing about the Catholic faith that I can remind you. And the best part about it is if, especially in Wisconsin, I mean, I can't say that everywhere, but in Wisconsin, they timed that mass service so it ended just before happy hour started. So you didn't have to miss a beat. And you didn't have to wake up early the next morning. That was the beauty of that whole thing. We golfed at that time, and I had said to Chris, I said, well, let's go golfing. Because on Sunday morning, you could get a tee time. Otherwise, you couldn't get a tee time down there anywhere on a Saturday. Well, she mentioned that she couldn't. She was going to church on Sunday. Foolishly, I said, well, why don't I join you? There was a reciprocal agreement, though. She said, well, you come to my church one Sunday, I'll go to yours the next. So the first Sunday I went to St. Wilfrid's Episcopal Church in Huntington Beach. Small little parish like this. Actually, the parish building was actually smaller than this one. And I remember just sort of connecting with people there. So a connection I didn't have with the parish I had, the Catholic church I was going to in the Lake Forest area. We left that service that day, and she said, so what time is Mass next week at your church? And I said, it's not. She looked at me, and I said, we'll be coming back here. I said, so she never actually even set foot in the Catholic Church on there because I didn't. there was no need for it, and I want to qualify this, and it wasn't because of some disdain or anything that I had for the Catholic Church. And I still don't. I've got a very large extended family there, but it was really just about finding a connection, finding family in the parish that we were at down there in St. Wilfrid's. Fast forward about 14 years, we were moving up here to Northern California. My daughters, Claire and Amelia, were middle school age at the time, and it was important for them to find a youth program. They had a strong youth program, a youth ministry down in St. Wilfrid's. Moving here, that was one of their questions. We were moving into the Minden area, I grew up with a tradition where we didn't church shop, so my two places to look at, and one was the Coventry Cross in Minden, Episcopal Church down there. I dutifully called the rector, and the conversation went something like this. I said, yeah, we're moving to the area and wanted to find out if you've got a youth program. Ah, so you have children. Yep, two daughters. Well, if you come here, then I guess we'll have a youth program. If you don't mind me asking, how old are you? Mid-40s. Ah, you'll be the youngest parishioner here by at least 20 years. At which point, and I have to say, by the way, the rector there was Father Stan, Shep Curtis, who to this day actually now is actually a very good family friend. But at the time, he had no idea who we were. And I remember him being very truthful and saying, I'm not sure this is the parish for you. You're welcome to be here, obviously, but you may want to look around. Again, not a church shopper. Called up Chris anyway, and when we moved up here, and I said, well, it looks like that church is out, but St. Gall's is a big church. I said, so I guess we'll go try that, which we did. We're there for about a month, and it brought back some of the memories of some of the parishes I'd been in, Catholic parishes in particular, because nobody made the announcement at this message, but the safety committee wants you to know where the fire extinguishers are and some of the things, so in case of an emergency, you know how to get out of here. In the Catholic Church, it's just about knowing where the exits are, because at the end of the service, whether they announce that there's a social hour or not, it's kind of the tradition, just bolt for the door. And you know, and you could spend a month, you can spend a year in that kind of environment and not really know anyone. What was sort of the last straw for our family was the Sunday we showed up, and they have a Hispanic congregation there, a ministry, and they were celebrating. I think it was the Feast of Guadalupe or something. It was a patron feast day down there. And as part of that, they were doing a fundraiser. So they're making homemade tamales and selling, and the group was selling tamales, which, by the way, were fabulous. So we went after the service to help with this fundraiser and realized that we were the only part of that congregation that wasn't part of the Hispanic congregation that actually showed up to help with their fundraiser. And that just didn't feel right. So that's when we decided to make the drive up here to Carson City and attend St. Peter's for the first time, which goes back about 12 years now. We attended here and have never looked back. Because what keeps us here was very simple, and that was we found family. We found an extended family in the congregation of the parishioners here. And I'll tell you, there's something about that, and that is that I'm looking up here at Brian. I know. There he is. And when I look at Brian, it reminds me that, you know, you're allowed to pick your friends, but you're stuck with your family. Someone asked me one time how do you define family, or what it really means to have family or have something, a connection like that. And I said it this way. I said, you know you've got family, or you know you've got a connection in a place when you wake up in the morning and you know that you get to do something. You get to go there. You get to help. You get to participate. And you don't have to. Because when you go through life thinking you have to do something, there's no fun in that. But when you get to do something, it opens up the possibilities and excitement. My father was the sort of what I call the definition of being generous. He was always willing to offer to help with anything, whether he actually knew how to do it or not. I kind of fall in that same trap. I followed in his footsteps. A couple of weeks ago when the furnace wasn't working, I had no clue what I was doing, but I didn't hesitate to not help. We came here. A few years after being here, I was on the vestry. Ended up being the senior warden, had no clue what I was doing. As a young boy in the Catholic Church, I was an altar boy. I mean, how could I refuse to be here if I can be an acolyte at my age? I mean, it's what makes this place special. And I want to share one last thing. My father recently passed away and had his eulogy. My daughter, Clara, reminded me that my father, her grandfather, had a smile you couldn't forget, a sense of humor that made you groan, you're wondering where you get mine from, and a quiet charm and a mischievous soul. My father was on the healing prayer list here at this church for the better part of the last year. His name, Philip, was read by members of this parish along with the first names of numerous others hundreds of times throughout that year. And I'm telling this to my this congregation back in Wisconsin for his eulogy. And I requested, when he passed away, I requested from the office that his name be moved from the prayer list over to the Repose of Souls. And I remember showing up that next Sunday. I was greeted with an extraordinary level of concern and compassion. It's exactly how I wanted and hoped an extended family would react to the loss of my father. But the irony was, and where my father would have found great humor in this, is it wasn't until I looked at the bulletin that Sunday morning and saw that his name, Philip Ritger, not just Philip, was in the bulletin, that I realized that most of you were wondering about the greatly exaggerated rumor of my demise. I know, in fact, Sally Bilyeu was very concerned that her husband was going to have to become treasurer again because because of that posting in the bulletin. So with that, I thank you. And thank you for being my extended family.
So, Phil, my takeaway at this service is the real advantage to being Roman Catholic is you can do Saturday night mass and then go tie one on afterwards. Phil, thank you so much. So there's Jesus, as I mentioned earlier. He's traveling around, and as we've pointed out in the Gospel according to Mark, this is the first century of the Common Era, and you know, Imperial Rome has sent in its troops once again, and they are decimating the countryside, destroying villages and towns, co-opting crops or burning them, taking families apart, going in, destroying the holy city of Jerusalem, all to establish peace. And so all this time that Jesus is traveling around with his friends, they're traveling this landscape that is just littered with broken, diseased, demon-possessed, maimed, and tortured bodies and people just coming at him left, right, and center. And we heard, I think, a couple of weeks ago where he's just trying to get away and folks are hunting him down. And he's able to heal many, but not all. And he exorcises many, but not all. His track record's a little iffy, again, in this wartime landscape of his, and those that are following him are also being inundated by this. I mean, they're overamping on the human need that is converging on Jesus. And the whole while that this is happening, he's every now and again he'll slip them a little teaching, and he'll say things like, "Oh, if you want to save your life, then you have to lose it." And they're going, What? Their senses are being overloaded and their minds are being blown consistently throughout this story. And now, Jesus takes three of them, the big three, Peter, James, and John, goes up the mountain. He is transfigured, and now their brains are exploding. And Peter, I love this guy, says, "Well, let's build three booths." And my answer is, "Yeah, let's." my version would be, let's build something with Legos. And actually, truth be told, because if you've ever worked with Legos, you know that they are really tiny pieces. I've gone through this with my kids and my grandkids, and they require a great deal of manual dexterity, hand-eye coordination, and the worst part of Legos is they require more than about a 45-second attention span. So Legos are actually a little out of my league. What I discovered early on that I still use with my grandkids is Duplos. You guys know Duplos? They're the big clunky blocks, and you can make something big in about 10 seconds. They're awesome. If I was up on the mountain with Jesus and my mind is getting blown like this and I see him transfigured, I'd be going, let's make something with Duplos. I get that. I mean, you know, there comes a point where we've been talking about spiritual experiences and mystical experiences, and we kind of get overloaded with this thing, or maybe we're giving ourselves a hard time. Gee whiz, maybe I'm not having enough spiritual experience. Maybe I haven't had the right kind of mystical experience. Wonder what he's really talking about here. And so we're getting a little antsy with this thing, and there comes a point where we say to ourselves, just give me something familiar. Something. Anything. I don't care. Duplos. Legos. Booths. You name it. I'll take it. And what I heard Phil suggesting today is that for many of us, for him and for Chris, and it certainly has become this for me over the years, is that you people are the familiar. I mean, when things are kind of feeling out of hand and, you know, maybe the whole spiritual thing is sort of out there spinning somewhere and I'm not quite getting it, when I need something familiar, it's right here with you. So, if you identify with Peter, welcome to the familiar. Give it up for Phil again. Take a moment, take a nice deep breath. Take another deep breath.